This is Only a Game. I'm Jason Gay. 1,698 players will make final NFL rosters at the end of this month. Most of them will have played their college football at the top programs in the country. You know, your Alabamas, Clemsons, and Ohio States. Some of them come from Division II. Only a dozen or so come from Division III. And only one will have played in the New England Small College Athletic Conference, NESCAC. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has this story.
One of the most unusual journeys to the NFL began in the valley below the Green Mountains, about midway between Burlington and Rutland, Vermont, on U.S. Route 7. That's where Middlebury College is located.
Yeah, so it's kind of in the middle of nowhere, Vermont, in the mountains.
That's Alex Buggy, who joined the Middlebury football team in 2003.
You're literally amongst cows, and Ben and Jerry's is just to the north, so they have great free ice cream in the cafeteria.
And is it fair to say that it's not exactly a football school?
Oh, yeah, that's an understatement.
Coming from the Midwest and you commit to go to play football at a school like Middlebury, people are just confused.
That's Scott Secor, one of Alex's teammates. When you were there, had Quidditch already started up?
So Quidditch started basically right when we got there. And amongst the football team members, it was kind of like a running joke. Sports Illustrated's coming to our school and they're covering Quidditch.
Hoping to improve on back-to-back 4-4 seasons, the football team arrived on campus early for a training camp in 2003. That meant Scott moved in well before his freshman roommate, a kid from Needham, Massachusetts, named Steve Hauschka. Over the summer, Scott had spoken with him on the phone.
I think the first question he had was what the size of our fridge could fit like a 30-pack of beer, but he said it in a way that's like, this guy seems like a little nerdy to me. He was a little bit out there, but he seems like a good guy.
By the time Steve arrived at Middlebury in his family's green minivan, Scott had already made friends.
Immediately, without knowing it, I showed up on campus and all the guys that were coming into the room were football players.
That's Steve Hauschka.
So that kind of immediately put me in with the football circle there.
Steve says it felt a little weird. He'd grown up playing soccer, and he was hoping to walk onto Middlebury's varsity team. But he only managed to play JV that fall.
Steve certainly was frustrated not being on the varsity squad.
Meanwhile, Alex and the rest of the football players had frustrations of their own.
We finished again, you know, at 500.
Our total field goal attempts were 2 for 5. So we kicked 5 field goals for an entire season. So the coach wasn't showing a lot of confidence in our kicker at the time.
We definitely needed to find someone that could play that position.
The exact sequence of events from here, who said what precisely when, isn't totally clear. But at some point, Alex and Scott came to learn something about Steve Hauschka, their tall, skinny friend who wasn't quite good enough for the Middlebury varsity soccer team.
Even watching him kick the ball, playing pickup soccer, you could tell, like, the kid's got a cannon. He's always had these big, strong legs.
Scott also learned that the Dallas Cowboys had shown an interest in his roommate's dad as a kicker in the 60s.
The story goes that they sent my dad the letter, but by the time he got the letter, something happened where he couldn't make it to training camp.
Not exactly a Hall of Fame career, but more than enough to get Scott, Alex, and the rest of the football guys excited.
You know, I think at first it might even started as a joke. Probably after a couple beverages in the dorm on a Wednesday night, just kind of kicking around and like, Steve, you get along with all the guys. We should give this a shot.
So they went to the field and Steve kicked some footballs.
Just smashing the ball, really without much training or thought.
That spring, Steve's friends got their coach, Bob Ritter, to come check out their potential ringer.
And I remember Coach Ritter just being floored with the distance these balls were traveling. Now, he was spraying them everywhere. There was not a ton of accuracy because kicking a football is a lot different than kicking a soccer ball. But he was absolutely crushing these balls. And I think we knew early on it was at least worth entertaining him coming out in the fall for a tryout.
Sophomore fall, Steve Hauschka walked on to the Middlebury football team as a place kicker and punter. And on September 25th, 2004, he made his football debut against Bowdoin College. With 11:43 to go in the second quarter, Steve had his first field goal chance, a 41-yarder. Now, just to be clear, in Division III, in the NESCAC, 41 is a long kick. The season before, Middlebury's longest field goal attempt had been from 34 yards, and it missed. So Steve lined up for the kick.
And I think I crushed it.
Steve says it would have been good from 60 yards or more.
And I remember it all happened so quickly. And then I kind of awkwardly ran back to the sideline and didn't even congratulate anybody or had like showed no emotion. At the time, I was just kind of out there kicking, and I didn't realize how much I would care if I made or missed it until after the game when I was 2 for 4. And I was like, man, I should have made all those. That initial feeling made me just work harder and harder.
For the record, the Middlebury archives suggest Steve was actually 1 for 3 in that first game and that he missed his only field goal attempt the next game. But Steve turned things around. He nailed his next 2 kicks against Amherst and Williams.
I remember practicing one day with Coach Wolf.
That was Steve's kicking coach.
And it was kind of midway through the season. I remember him saying, you're good enough. You have a strong enough leg to play professional football. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, you can play in the NFL. And I thought he was totally full of it. I'm barely through my first season. You know, I don't even know if I'm going to be the starting kicker the next season. And he's telling me I can be an NFL kicker.
Steve ended up going 6 for 10 on field goals his rookie season. That next year, he went 4 for 6. And senior year, just his 3rd season of football, Steve Hauschka came into his own on field goals and in punting. In the second game, Middlebury took on Colby College. Steve pinned Colby inside its 20-yard line on 4 different punts. Middlebury won 23-0. And even though another player recorded 6 sacks, and even though Steve never played a defensive snap, his punting was so good that he was named the conference's Defensive Player of the Week. He kept it up.
He was dropping punts inside the 5-yard line pretty regularly.
On kickoffs, Scott says Steve would sometimes send the ball through the uprights.
Which was always fun to see the reaction of the other team. Like, where did they find this guy?
And on field goals, Steve went 10 for 12. That year, Middlebury finished 6-2, its best record in 6 seasons.
We're pretty close to winning an NESCAC championship, and a lot of that was because of Steve.
Steve was preparing to graduate with a degree in neuroscience, but he still had a year of college eligibility left. He decided to try to play for a Division I team as a grad transfer.
Pretty much called up every Division I program that had either had a kicker graduate or the kicker didn't do well the season before. That was, I don't know, 45, 50 schools, calling all these random numbers. They're all on different time zones. And, like, they thought I was full of it. Nobody listened. Nobody cared.
Steve says he did get a bit of interest to kick at Baylor and NC State.
And then there was 2 months where I didn't hear anything from anybody. And I was like, okay, this is done. You know, my football career is done before it even really got a chance to get going. And I remember getting the call from the coaches at NC State saying, hey, we got you a spot to, you know, walk on at training camp. Immediately, I got so excited. I went down, visited NC State. I put up a poster of, like, their stadium in my room. And I started, like, visualizing kicking in front of all these thousands of people.
So that next fall, Steven Hauschka showed up at NC State. Playing time was no guarantee. NC State had other kickers on the roster. Not to mention, the team had also misspelled his name. He was listed as Steven with a V instead of a PH. But he didn't want to be a bother.
So I didn't say anything about it. I was excited just, you know, to have a jersey and to have most of my name up there, right?
But Steven Hauschka made the team and became NC State's starting kicker.
I do remember the week, though, leading up to that first game and just being, like, so nervous for it and so excited, too.
Steve says he felt like at Middlebury, if he had a bad game, he'd be letting his teammates down, but other people wouldn't be upset.
But at NC State, I knew how much football meant.
With 6:14 to go in the first half of NC State's season opener, Steve Hauschka, former Middlebury JV soccer player, walked onto the field in front of 57,000 people to attempt his first field goal as a Division I football player. He nailed it from 29 yards. In fact, through NC State's first 8 games, Steve didn't miss. Then, in the 9th game, NC State went to overtime at the University of Miami. Steve had a chance for a game-winning kick.
Steven Hauschka for the win from 42 yards out. The spot, the kick, on the way. And it's good. North Carolina State has won.
Steve ran off the field with his helmet raised in his right hand. His NC State teammates lifted him in the air. Steve Hauschka had been thinking about attending dental school after NC State, but after making 16 of 18 field goals, and after being named a semifinalist for the Top College Kicking Award, Steve decided to give pro football a shot. He wasn't picked in the 2008 NFL draft, but he was quickly signed by the Minnesota Vikings. The problem? Minnesota already had a veteran kicker. Steve's chances of landing a spot on the team weren't very good. Here's his former roommate, Scott.
The first reaction was, man, we got to try to make it to as many preseason games as possible because this is the coolest thing ever. Who knows how long it's going to last?
In the second week of preseason, the Vikings traveled to Baltimore to play the Ravens, a team that did need a kicker. In the third quarter, Steve made a 48-yard field goal. Alex Buggy was there.
We were probably the loudest guys cheering about a preseason 49, 50-yard field goal because we were jumping out of our seats going crazy.
After the game, Alex spoke with Steve.
And I told him, I said, I think you just won yourself a job because you kicked a 49, 50-yard field goal against a team that needs a kicker.
What did he say when you told him that?
Same demeanor, super placid, like, yeah, need to go back to work and kind of refine some things.
Before the 2008 NFL season began, the Baltimore Ravens signed Steven Hauschka, still misspelled with a V. No matter, 5 years after showing up at Middlebury College in the green minivan with hopes of playing varsity soccer, he was on an NFL team, and he stuck around. Steven Hauschka was the kicker for the 2013 Super Bowl-winning Seattle Seahawks. Scott and Alex were both in the stands for that one. In 2 weeks, Steven Hauschka, who in 2017 signed an $8.85 million contract with the Buffalo Bills, will begin his 12th NFL season. And they're finally spelling his name right.
Everyone else is like transitioning into their, you know, their prime or their careers. It's like, oh, Steve's still kicking footballs, huh?
Yeah, but you have to remember, he did get a pretty late start.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef. Traceability so bold that customers can even know the genetic pedigree of their steak or burger. From a six-generation family ranch in the Nebraska Sandhills, Honest Beef is dedicated to telling the story of your beef. Follow along on Instagram to see their life on the ranch, working to provide their customers with high-quality, dry-aged beef that they can feel great about. From their ranch to your door, they'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
Hey, it's not just you. This week does feel like it's gone on forever. When it is over, join me, Sam Sanders, to get some perspective. Catch my show, It's Been a Minute, where we look back on the news and culture and everything else. Download it every weekend from NPR.
I'm Jason Gay, and it's time for three stories you should know.
And oh, God! Oh my gosh! A grand slam for Reese Roussel, his 12th hit at the Little League World Series.
It's that time of year again when this country goes wild over the athletic feats of 12-year-olds. And that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Amira Rose Davis, Penn State professor and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. And via Skype, ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. Welcome back to both of you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Jason.
This might come as a shock to you, Amira Rose and Don, but youth sports in the United States of America, they're not perfect.
That is brand new information.
Fewer kids are playing. Less than 40% of children aged 6 to 12 are now playing an organized sport in America. That's from a study by the Aspen Institute and Utah State. At the same time, there's this surge of spending and specialization. Parents who are willing to pay big bucks for a shot or a theoretical shot at a college scholarship or preferred admission. You know, it just turns out that sports, like a lot of other elements in this country, is becoming a land of the haves and the have-nots. A lot of talent being denied for the simple reason they can't foot the bill. Aspen Center for Sports and Society believes there might be an interesting solution, or at least kind of a release valve, in bringing back the concept of town sports, in-town recreational sports, good old-fashioned, low-key, nobody travels, ice cream truck, town sports. Is that perhaps a step in the right direction from the insanity that has become youth sports in this country?
Absolutely. It's a great idea in theory, but unfortunately, so many parents are just showing themselves to be really, really bad examples for their children, right? We've got bad sportsmanship. We've got kids, you know, they're seeing their parents spending lots of money to try to buy their way into a scholarship. I love the idea of town sports. It's a lovely idea. It's a quaint idea, but I'm not sure it's going to happen right away.
I don't know where these parents came from. I was lucky when I was growing up if my dad slowed down the car slow enough that I could get out to go to practice. Yeah. I mean, he was not hanging out. He was not, like, yelling from the sidelines. But that was probably a good thing.
You know, there's a huge time emphasis in youth sports as well as the financial emphasis. And for working parents, particularly parents who work more than one job, this is just as problematic when you're at a very young age being forced to choose a sport for your child to really prioritize because at that level, the practices are 4 or 5 days a week. To me, that is one of the biggest issues, is that children are being asked to choose and prioritize a sport on the idea that it's going to get them financial scholarships or, you know, bigger dreams. But before they've had a chance to try anything, and at that level, what happens is you're tracked into sports that people think that you're good at based on how you look, how much money you have, etc. And we're really cutting off the pathways to, you know, all sorts of different expressions of athletic ability.
100%. And I think probably both of you had conversations at one point or another with professional athletes who are relaying their story of how they became professional athletes. And it's shocking to me, in my experience, how many of them came to their professional sport late. They did other things. They danced. They played soccer. They tried it all.
Yes.
Amira Rose, you're next here.
Yeah, so this past week, Steph Curry announced a partnership with Howard University to fund their men's and women's golf teams for 6 seasons, starting in the 2021 season. This is really significant. Howard's golf team, like many golf teams at historically black colleges and universities, have been struggling for finances, for recruitment. This will fund coaches. It will fund equipment. They are going to get hooked up with Under Armour gear, as well as funding scholarships on both the men's and women's side. And I just wanted to use this moment to think about actually the long history that historically black colleges and universities have had with men's and women's golf teams dating back to the teens and the 20s. There's a great book called Game of Privilege by Lane Demas that you can check out if you want more history about this. But my question to you guys is this gesture going to work without any other assets thrown into the pipeline? So where are they recruiting from? Is a gesture by one person, does it actually start momentum perhaps to get funding for golf programs and other kind of marginalized sports at these schools?
Don?
Well, I would hope so. It's a remarkable gift by Steph Curry. It's certainly a great first step. And if he set up a foundation and tried to recruit other athletes and other people, doesn't have to be athletes, to give money to programs like this, it'd be great. Because I read that it needs about $8 million, I think, after Steph Curry's seed money for Howard runs out, another $8 million is needed. That's a lot of money.
I mean, I understand what you're saying, though, Amir Rose, that you want to get beyond just the goodwill of individual donors. It starts to sound a little bit like the newspaper business to me, candidly. You know, the idea that you're just going to have some white knight fly in and just solve everything. That just is not a great way to run a business long term, because you're at the whim of somebody's pocketbook.
Certainly. And beyond that, golf at historically black colleges and universities, if you just look at teams like Alabama State, out of the 6 people on the team, there might be 2 black Americans on that team, including the Canadian kid who came down for a golf scholarship and didn't realize that he was going to a black college, which cracks me up. But there's a pipeline problem. It goes back to the youth sports that you were talking about.
Yeah. All right, Don, we're solving all the problems of the planet Earth. You're up next. No pressure.
The U.S. Open begins Monday. It marks the one-year anniversary of the controversial 2018 women's final, Serena Williams going for her 24th record-tying Grand Slam singles title against young Naomi Osaka. But as we all remember, Serena really clashed with the chair umpire Carlos Ramos of Portugal. I have devoted the last 8 or 9 months of my life to sort of investigating the backstory of that match. And this is going to be a really shameless plug here, guys, maybe the most shameless in the history of Only a Game. I'm now hosting an ESPN docuseries called Backstory. The debut episode is out, Serena versus the umpire. And in particular, we look closely at the coaching violation and almost Zapruder film show in a split screen, Patrick Mouratoglou, Serena's coach, making a hand motion while Serena sees it, and then Patrick, the coach, nods. So I have a question for you guys. Are you team Serena or team Carlos Ramos?
Yeah, Serena all the way. not even a question for me. I mean, I think that there's a lot of complexities into that interaction. But, you know, part of the history of both Serena and Venus has been very real issues with umpires. The umpires were so aggrieved after this. You can't see me. I'm rolling my eyes. it was a mess of a situation, and I felt for Naomi incredibly in that moment. And that was like the biggest thing that stayed with me from it still.
I get to say something really cool. I was there. Naomi Osaka was about to dethrone, you know, the greatest tennis player who's ever lived. And to take a little bit of that shine off was disappointing. But I sort of think that there's this trouble that tennis has created for itself and the elevation of these coaches. We do so much choreography, and television has a hand here now, where we're showing the coaches nonstop in the course of the match, the body language of the coach, the wife, the husband, the children. There's all this kind of subplots. And it seems to me to be so strange that we've created a construct where we're going to make these people characters in the action, but they can't actually do anything. So I think tennis has to kind of get down under the hood and figure out what the heck they're going to do about coaching. And if they don't want it, I don't know if these people need to be courtside, and they certainly don't need to be television characters.
Either way, they need to be consistent.
Yeah.
That's right. But you're absolutely right, Jason. The fact that a coach sitting courtside at a Grand Slam cannot send a signal, can't coach, can't do his job, is ridiculous. Coaching goes on everywhere except in tennis. It's an antiquated rule. And the U.S. Open, you know, made a move to change it and still can't get support from Wimbledon, the French Open, and the Australian Open, unfortunately. But I think eventually we will see coaching even in the Grand Slams. I think it's only a matter of time.
Don, Patrick told you this was the first time he had actually sent a coaching signal to Serena during a match. Do you believe that for 1 second?
I did not believe it. No, I did not believe that.
I can't believe you said that.
Yeah. And then when I asked him, why did you nod, he had an explanation saying he's really not sure. He needs glasses. He couldn't see Serena looking his way, which I also didn't believe. So, he was scrambling.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Amira Rose Davis, Penn State professor and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast, and via Skype, ESPN, and Backstory host, Don Van Natta Jr. Thanks to both of you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, JG.
Last season, Fort William FC was the worst football team in the Highland League, Scotland's lowest tier. They hadn't won a game in more than 2 years. Even Fort Williams' own fans had started disparaging the team at home games. But then, someone raised his hand and offered to help. Someone who also knew what it was like to fall very, very low. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
If you ask Russell McMorrin what he does for work, he'll tell you he's a police officer.
I joined the police when I was 27. I've been in it for 16 years, and I've loved every minute of it. It's a fantastic job.
McMorrin cruised the Scottish Highlands on his police motorcycle. One of his jobs was to be a first responder at crash scenes, where he witnessed severe injury and death. Lots of it.
Being inside wrecked cars becomes a normal occurrence that you don't think there's anything wrong with it. but you're actually, you physically and mentally, you're changing. Nothing would appear to have bothered me, but clearly it obviously was ticking away inside. So eventually it gets to that point where it tips. I was okay at work. I was normal at work, come home. You're irritable, you're probably the worst person to be around, but you don't realize it.
McMoran saw a doctor, and months later, his suspicions were confirmed.
So September, I got the formal diagnosis that it was complex PTSD, which means not just one traumatic incident, but it's a number of incidents throughout the 16 years of service.
McMoran went on medical leave in early 2018. He did a lot of staring at the walls of his home. He says it was hard, especially for his wife, Laura, and their kids.
Didn't want to speak to anyone, didn't want to leave the house. I didn't want to bump into anybody I knew. So Laura suggested getting back into football.
McMoran had played on the first squad of Inverness Caledonian Thistle, another team in Scotland's lowest tier. But a knee injury ended his career at what he calls the ripe old age of 22. Still, he remained a big fan of the game. So in September of 2018, Laura persuaded him to attend an open meeting at the clubhouse of Fort William FC, the team many called Britain's worst.
It's a very run-down place, you know, and there was about 10 to 15 people sitting. It was an open meeting, but obviously wasn't very well attended.
At the time, the team had just a handful of players under contract. The entire management board had resigned. No one was sure there'd be a next season.
You could see where the club was. They were in dire straits. Obviously, it was going to be a challenge.
Someone asked for a show of hands for volunteers to help in any way they could. Russell raised his.
And before I knew it, I was club secretary almost within 2 or 3 days.
Club secretary is what Americans would call a general manager. McMoran, who didn't like to leave his house, would be running the team.
I didn't know how it was going to go to start with, but very quickly realized that it was a good thing.
McMoran went right to work. He began by securing a new management board.
The problems that were there were deep-rooted, and it became normal that the club was bottom of the league, and we need to change the simple things, the standards and discipline and the image of the club, for a start.
He must have done a good job, because a few months later, in January 2019...
The decision was made by the board that I would take up the interim manager's role until the end of the season.
That's manager as in coach. McMoran began by doing what he could to make things better for the players, including renovation of the dilapidated clubhouse. And there were matches to play, or matches to lose, lots of them. But then on February 16th, Fort William played Nairn County FC at home. Their pitch was flooded after hours of torrential rain. That's known to sometimes happen in Scotland. The team slogged through water that was sometimes ankle deep. Fort William scored first. Having any lead at all was a rare occurrence. Maybe, just maybe, Fort William had a chance to win a match. But just before halftime, the game was called by the referee. It must have been terribly disappointing that you couldn't walk away with your first win.
Yeah, absolutely, but that was a small victory for them anyway.
Fort William FC's season ended without a win, again. In 34 games, the team scored just 21 goals and allowed 245, an average of more than 7 per game. McMoran went to work in the off-season. He emphasized fitness and positive mental attitude to all 4 players who showed up on the first day of training camp.
I would challenge anybody to try and put a side together, regardless of what the level is, with only 4 players turning up.
Just days before the current season began, McMoran negotiated a loan of 9 players from his former club, Inverness Caledonian Thistle. Fort William FC lost its first match 6-0. To some, it looked like business as usual. In the second game of the season, on July 31st, Fort William again faced Nairn County FC, and then something magical happened.
Go on! Go on!
We got the first goal, and that was within, I think it was 12 minutes, followed very quickly by a second goal, a great goal. You know, going 2-0 up, it's something that they're not used to, so they panicked a wee bit.
At halftime, McMorrin told the players that they'd get the win if they just stuck with what they'd been doing in the first half. And they did. The final score was 5-2 in favor of the guys who could argue that they needed that result more than any other team in Britain. After the match, the Fort William players gathered in the clubhouse and chanted their manager's name.
That just is the tip of the iceberg of how the guys were feeling. Unfortunately for them, it was a Wednesday night and not a Saturday, so they couldn't fully enjoy themselves.
Fort William hasn't put together a string of wins yet, but attendance is way up. McMorrin says last season the team would be lucky to draw 60 people. This year, average attendance is around 300, and none of the home fans are disparaging the players anymore. It's been almost a year since Russell McMorrin's PTSD diagnosis. He says he's feeling better. He hopes to return to the police force someday.
You know, that decision isn't mine to make, whether I'm fit enough to go back to do a role within the police force. And if I'm not, then yeah, I'll look at maybe some form of coaching. I don't think Man United or Man City or Barcelona will be knocking on my door very soon. You know, I've been really, really low in my life. I think when you have the outlook that you have to stay positive and look for the small positives in everything. Anything can happen. In the great scheme of everything, it's only a game.
It's good to be reminded of that, even when you work on a show called, well, you know.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. When Tomas Silva showed up to his first arm wrestling competition, he felt a bit out of place.
These people were big. They had tattoos. They were like chugging protein shakes and creatine. Like, whoa, what did I get myself into?
Coming up, how Tomas uses arm wrestling to bring people together. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
While you're sleeping, a whole bunch of news is happening around the world. Up first is the NPR News podcast that gets you caught up on the big news in a small amount of time. Spend about 10 minutes with Up First on weekday mornings from NPR News.
I'm Jason Gay. Next week on Only a Game, the true story of the Clemson $2 bill. It's legal tender, it features orange tiger paw prints, and it may be coming to your college football town soon. But first, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Jason.
Charlie, the U.S. national women's soccer team's gender discrimination lawsuit against USA Soccer is scheduled for May 2020. Now, that's just barely ahead of the Tokyo Summer Olympics. That means this is going to be this high-profile trial heading into that big mega competition. Is it good to get this thing out of the way before the Olympics, or is this a potential, you know, distraction heading into
it? I think it's probably a distraction, but it's also leverage.
Yeah.
I think the women, who have a heck of a case, by the way, they have a lot of leverage going into the Olympics. They will be one of the marquee attractions in the Olympics, especially for American television. And if they wind up saying, well, you know, we're all hung up with this lawsuit here and I don't know if we can play, that's going to put a lot of pressure on U.S. soccer, and it's not going to come from players this time. It's going to come from television networks.
I just can't believe USA Soccer is just willing to let this thing go on and on and on, rattling after the World Cup months and months.
They'll let it go on, you know, at least till the end of the year, certainly, but I have a feeling you're going to see a settlement sometime in the spring.
All right. On Thursday, the Oakland Raiders and the Green Bay Packers played a preseason game in Winnipeg on an 80-yard field. Why? Can you tell me?
Well, there was a hole in the end zone. it was, of course, a Canadian Football League field, which is larger than an NFL field.
Right.
But there was this hole in the end zone, and people were afraid that it would be completely unsafe if, you know, you're running over the middle and all of a sudden you disappear into Middle Earth. And, you know, that you don't know if you're going to get a little break on the salary cap if your guy gets swallowed up by the planet. So they played for 80 yards.
Now, was this hole because of, like, the stanchion of the field goal that they have there in Canadian football? As you said, the dimensions are different.
Yeah, pretty much. They had to move the goalpost. I don't know why they couldn't have played, by the way, with the Canadian Football League goalpost, why they had to go to all this fuss. But apparently they did, and that left a hole in the field. Apparently there was one other game played in a field shorter than 100 yards. The first playoff game between the Chicago Bears and the Portsmouth Spartans. Oh, you may remember the legendary Portsmouth Bruins. Anyway, it was the league's first playoff game. It was played inside. It was played in Chicago Stadium, the old hockey arena with the giant organ. Yeah. So in 1932, arena football was invented, although nobody ever knew there would be a market for it.
Fantastic. This week, the Houston Astros denied a reporter from the Detroit Free Press access to pitcher Justin Verlander in the clubhouse after a Tigers-Astros game. Per baseball's rules, this kind of thing is not allowed. But the Astros seemed okay with violating the rule and risking a possible fine from the league in order to placate their star. You okay with this?
No, it's terrible, and Verlander should know better, and the Astros should know better. It has to do with a Detroit Free Press writer named Anthony Fenich, who apparently had some problems with Verlander, or Verlander had problems with him back when Verlander was with the Tigers. But that's a while ago. I mean, get over it, guy. You're a multi-million dollar, ace, major league pitcher. Try to get over the fact that you've got some kind of beef going with a local reporter in a city where you don't even play anymore.
In this week's Art Imitates Basketball Life Department, artist Jules Muck likes to paint murals. She did one recently on a residential building featuring Indiana native and hoops superstar Larry Bird. And then she heard from Larry Bird's lawyer. What was the problem?
She put tattoos on Larry. And one of the tattoos has a couple of rabbits doing things that you don't want to be, like, having them do on your arm. There's a spider web. There's a shamrock, obviously, for the Celtics. There's a number 76. I don't know what's going on there. Get the tats off Larry. Larry doesn't do tats. Come on.
Charlie, I'm going to assume here you've interviewed a shirtless Larry Bird at one point in your career. There are no tats at all?
No tats. Are you kidding? It's Larry. No tats. The artist, by the way, will be removing all the tattoos except for the one that says Indiana on Larry's left arm. So
I know. They were okay with that one. Well, who doesn't like a nice Indiana tattoo on their arm? And finally, Charlie, last Sunday night, the Cubs and the Pittsburgh Pirates played in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, where the Little League World Series is underway. A fun time was had by all, especially for the Little Leaguers from East Bank, Louisiana, who openly mocked Cubs reliever Craig Kimbrel while he was on the mound. To what manner of mockery did the young scallywag subject Kimbrel?
Well, Kimbrel has this very strange pre-pitch stance where he looks like a vulture, descending on a piece of carrion by the side of the road. And so they all stood up and did it back at him. His very first pitch, by the way, was hit for a home run. So I think we can say that the gang from East Bank really, really unnerved him. Those of us who remember his performance here in Boston, refer to him as Six Flags Over Kimbrel, the greatest rope park ride of all time. But I think the East Bank folks, they win the heckling award for this week for sure.
Charlie Pierce joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Jason.
Friends, listeners, Romans, I just want to give you a little heads up. Labor Day weekend is right around the corner. Maybe you're going for a long drive. You know what would be great for that long drive? A big bag of beef jerky. No, binging the Only a Game archives. Am I right? Of course I'm right. Subscribe to the Only a Game podcast on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, everywhere great podcasts are shown. If you look at Tomas Silva's resume, you'll see that he's a successful businessman in Santiago. He went to the country's top university, studied in the United States, and speaks three languages. But what might stand out to you is this.
When I go somewhere, even with childhood friends, the tank, the arm wrestler. And it's not just a hobby anymore. They know me. I'm known for arm wrestling.
Reporter Paige Sutherland has the story from Santiago.
Tomas Silva has been a professional arm wrestler for 5 years now. But in Chile, arm wrestling is not a sport for business people. It's a sport for
more vulnerable people that don't come from this, more comfortable background.
Most Chileans would classify these people as flighté.
Flighté has a connotation of, sketchy or ghetto.
And Tomás would be called cuico.
Cuico is an upper class person, someone that has an education at university, someone that most of the time comes from a European background. They dress different, they speak different, they look different. You can tell right away.
And these two classes rarely mix. That distinction is embedded in Chile's history. and it was only made worse by Augusto Pinochet's decades-old dictatorship, which ended in 1989. Tomas says the upper class tends to look positively on these years as a time of stabilization and economic progress. But many in the lower working class remember it as a time of imprisonment and even death.
This is probably the biggest challenge in Chile. It goes beyond arm wrestling. It goes beyond sports. It's an idiosyncrasy. What makes us Chileans?
But Tomas is trying to bridge that gap between Flaite and Cuico, in part through arm wrestling. Growing up, Tomas attended a private French school in Osorno, a small conservative town in the south of Chile. Like most of his classmates, he swam and played tennis and golf. But to him, these sports were missing something.
I was always obsessed or very fond of strength. Not really like the looks. I mean, I respect that, but I'm not that way. I like being strong.
Tomas was one of the smallest guys in his class, reaching a mere 5'7 and weighing in at about 145 pounds. But he was strong.
One of the sports where you can show that strength is arm wrestling, right? And from a very early age, I was doing it and I got really into it.
Tomas never considered arm wrestling a serious sport, just kind of a hobby. But when he spent a year studying abroad at a Colorado high school, he brought that same hobby with him.
I was at a party and I was arm wrestling someone, and like the guy said, Tomas, you should really look into this. I know it's a sport. They have it in the U.S. It's not as big as football, of course, but you should really look into it.
So he did.
And I went on Google. I got excited. It was a dream. I was like, oh, I really want to meet people that do this. I want to learn. I want to do it with passion. But then like 3 weeks later, I was back in Osorno and there was no one to look up to, like a role model. It was just me.
Tomas moved to Santiago for college. He got a finance job, and then one day he stumbled upon a Facebook group for local arm wrestlers.
I thought it was a joke. I thought it was just like, oh, like a fan page. And I saw this thing on Facebook, like first professional, like local competition. And I said, why don't I go? I got so excited.
But the competition was in a dangerous neighborhood of the city with a higher crime rate. So he asked his older cousin to go with him.
I was a little nervous.
The competition was held at a local gym. Tomas says there were about 20 to 30 guys there, and most of them looked like they've been there before.
These people were big. They had tattoos. They were like chugging protein shakes and creatine. Like, whoa, what did I get myself into? And then they brought us to this basement sort of thing, lights out and everything. And I was like, oh, okay. And they had like mirrors everywhere, like a kind of a like underground gym. They could tell right away I spoke differently.
Tomas doesn't use much slang. He speaks slower and is more pronounced. So he stood out easily, especially that day to one of the regulars at the competition.
He even called me a gringo, like, and I'm not even like blonde, but honestly, when we got into the actual sport, the actual competition, it didn't matter anymore.
Tomas did really well. He placed first in the amateur field with both his left arm and his right, and he took third in the professional. He was hooked.
I went back home with like 3 medals, and everybody was so impressed, like, wow, well, this is something. And after that, I don't recall looking back.
His arms were so sore. He says he didn't sleep for 3 days. But while he was lying in bed, he couldn't help but think about what he was going to do next. If he wanted to get better, he needed people to train with. So he reached out to some guys he met at the competition.
And they lived so far away from where I lived. I took like 5 metros, 3 buses. Took me like 2.5 hours to show up at this training session that they had. And it was like the sketchiest neighborhood I had ever seen. But it didn't matter because like these people were so welcoming to me. Like I knew I had met amazing people and I wanted to be part of that group.
Tomas works full-time as a data scientist in Santiago. So commuting 2.5 hours twice a week for training wasn't possible. So he asked around and found a guy who could make him an arm wrestling table for his apartment. After that, he wanted to start hosting his own training sessions, but his roommates weren't too fond of the idea.
At that point, I was living with my siblings, and they were like, whoa, who are you going to invite to our place? They were even joking about it, like, hey, I'm going to have to hide my computer. I'm going to have to hide everything. My siblings are like very, very good people, and they would never mean it in a very serious way. But still, they joke about it, so that means that there is something there. I said, if you're not going to allow me to have this, I love it so much, I'm gonna have to move out and find a spot where I can do it.
Eventually, his siblings came around.
We put the table on the balcony, and then I invited a few people, and I was so happy with it. We had like chalk, like for the gripping, like the strap, the actual table, the shirts, and then we took photos and we posted them online.
After that, Tomas started competing often. In March, he traveled 5 hours by bus to an event.
I said, okay, I'm going to stay at a hotel. And like these people said, no, stay with us. Stay with us. Why not? You know I'm going to stay with them. I slept on the floor on a mattress with like two other people. I didn't really care. These people with very low resources, they're the most giving people. They're like always trying to share with people what they have.
Tomas started to feel like he was living two lives, one as a businessman and another as an arm wrestler. So he decided to host a competition at a sports bar in his own neighborhood in hopes that these two groups might mix.
It was like very divided, like the arm wrestling crew and like my group of friends. They like naturally like separate. And it was a little frustrating for me because I had to pay attention to my friends, then the other group. And I was like so busy, not even competing, but like paying attention to everybody to make sure they were okay. And you have two people like sitting right next to each other. They won't talk to each other because they know they come from like different classes. It's unbelievable.
Tomas's plan didn't work, but he kept trying. He kept inviting some of his closest friends in the arm wrestling community to events, including his last birthday party, where things went a little differently.
I was so happy with it because I saw everybody at my place, in my house, talking to each other, and I didn't have to like put energy into like making sure everybody was comfortable with everything. That time I said, maybe I have to start small, but it can happen if you give it an opportunity.
Tomas now hosts weekly training sessions in his apartment. He even travels internationally for competitions. His two worlds haven't quite mixed, but Tomas isn't giving up. He says every chance he gets, he'll continue to try to narrow the gap.
At the table, it doesn't matter where you're from. You could be the most richest person in the world, or you might have a few bucks to eat every day. At the table, it doesn't matter.
That story came from reporter Paige Sutherland in Santiago. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Kyrie Thompson. Our intern is Arlo Moore Bloom. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Karen Given. I'm Jason Gay. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.